It's Friday, November 15, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Time and again, we come back to the fact that we are made as moral creatures. Morality may change, but human beings remain intensely moral. Those who suggest that what we need to do is to leave behind a certain morality always inevitably end up putting up another morality in its place. As Christians, we know that's because of the way God made us, in His image, as moral creatures. We are inescapably, inevitably moral. A really interesting testimony to this recently appeared at The Atlantic, one of the most influential magazines in America. Connor Friesdorf writing an article entitled, Is America Less Moralistic Now, or Has Its Moral Code Just Changed? It is a really insightful article. He asks, are the American people more suspicious than they once were of moralism and public policy? He cites Russ Douthat of the New York Times, whom I cited already in this specific column, where he writes about the specific issues of same-sex marriage and the acceptance of marijuana, and says these could only now be possible because of a vast secularization of the culture. He cites Douthat as writing, both have been made possible by the same trend in American attitudes, the rise of a live-and-let-live social libertarianism, the weakening influence of both religious conservatism and liberal communitarianism, the growing suspicion of moralism in public policy, end quote. Then, Friesdorf writes, it's a plausible theory, but the last line about moralism makes me want to quibble. Maybe Americans want public policy to reflect their moral judgments as much as ever, but they no longer regard smoking marijuana or casino gambling or sodomy, gay marriage, or pornography consumption as morally suspect. That's an amazing statement, amazing in its candor and probably, at least in large part, in its accuracy. It's also interesting in that it comes from someone who is trying to counter the argument that America is less moralistic. Connor Friesdorf writes back, it's not moralistic, he thinks, it's that the moral code is simply changed. To be blunt, he writes, citizens don't harbor suspicion toward moralism so much as toward certain parts of traditional morality. Here again, I think he's right. As a matter of fact, this is a secular testimony to the same kind of moral perception that Christians deeply grounded in the Christian worldview should also see, if for different reasons, seeing the same reality. He writes about the current moral context in America, and then he writes, what's definitely grown larger is the subset of Americans who not only disagree with the notion that gay marriage or smoking marijuana or watching pornography is immoral, but can't even understand the moral logic of traditionalists, end quote. Here again, very revealing, the kind of statement we directly need to hear. Here we are being told that those who believe that homosexuality is sinful, those who believe that watching pornography is immoral, those who believe that smoking marijuana is morally significant, are not only out of step with the larger society, but the society increasingly can't understand the moral logic of the moral traditionalists. This is why you get so many blank stares in conversation. This is why when young people arrive on the college and university campus, they find themselves almost overwhelmed by a tidal wave of moral logic that runs directly against almost everything they've been taught. This is why those in the liberal media and in the secular elites, when they talk to someone who is a moral traditionalist, they not only can't understand them, but they can't even understand the logic that the moral traditionalist is putting forward. What you have here is what we've talked about over the past several years. You have a direct reversal of the moral code. Friesdorf makes that very clear when he writes, on gay marriage, many, he includes himself in this, would go so far as to say that it is immoral to prohibit same-sex unions. So in other words, you have a morality that is very clear and which is very moralistic, as moral systems inevitably are. They're making the moral judgment that to oppose the legalization of same-sex marriage is immoral, even as those who oppose same-sex marriage are arguing that it's same-sex marriage that is immoral. Connor Friesdorf is exactly right when he says both are making moral arguments. It is a rare secular honesty to see so clearly that it is so. He's not finished with his argument. He writes this, traditionalists have seen their ability to control social norms decline precipitously in my lifetime. And given the way they conceive of moral behavior, you can see how, looking around, they conclude that moralism is dead. He's writing about us there. He's saying that we're wrong to think moralism is dead. He's right about that. It's not. He then writes, I'm not sure. I still see a lot of policy fights framed in highly moralistic language and arguments. And insofar as traditionalists are losing ground, it's often because what they regard as immoral strikes a majority as morally unobjectionable, end quote. He's right. In other words, what we have here is not just a disagreement, not just a collision of two different moral judgments. We have the inability of two different moral systems to understand the logic of one another. That's what's happening in so many conversations. Maybe that's what's not happening in so many conversations, but what is revealed in them. We're living in a world in which the moral traditionalists, those who hold to a biblical understanding of morality, that understanding of morality and that moral system that characterized Western civilization for centuries, we find ourselves in the position of having to do what in previous eras we did not have to do. Explain the moral logic. It's not enough to state our position. We have the responsibility to articulate and to explain that position and to place it in the larger context of moral thinking. If we do not, it'll just be isolated sound bites doing war in the public square. And at that battle, we are losing. In terms of reaching the heart, we need to understand that there's a big job to be done there, but that's our business. We should be articulating the issues, stating the positions, but more than that, speaking out of conviction and explaining the logic of those convictional understandings. No one said it was going to be easy, but Connor Frierstorff is exactly right. Easy or not, it's the job that has to be done. And he is profoundly right when he makes very clear that moralism isn't gone. It's just at the ground of moralism. And furthermore, the logic behind the new moralistic system is so much at odds with that which came before. That gives us an enormous responsibility. But we also better see it as an enormous opportunity as well. Speaking of that incredible moral revolution, that moral shift that's taking place around us, every once in a while an article appears or an event happens that simply seems to cry out with flashing neon effect, here is that moral shift in full evidence. The last issue of Rolling Stone magazine included an article that makes this point. It is entitled, About a Girl. Sabrina Rubin Erdely, writing the article, writes, by the time Coy Mathis was 4 years old, he knew one thing was for sure, that he wasn't a boy. Coy Mathis has been in the national news before. We talked about him on The Briefing when a Colorado legal decision was handed down saying that the public schools in Colorado Springs had to allow him to use the girls' bathroom, even though he was born a boy. The article in Rolling Stone magazine, and Rolling Stone, by the way, is often an indicator of where the counterculture is, but it's on the near side of the counterculture, that counterculture that's closest to mainstream culture. Rolling Stone writes that Coy Mathis had a very early gender issue. Very early, as early as he was able to talk and walk, he made very clear that he was identifying as a girl rather than a boy. His parents thought this was a phase, but it turned out not to be a phase. According to his parents, when he was still a preschooler, he asked his mom at bedtime, when are we going to go to the doctor to have me fixed to get my girl parts? According to Rolling Stone, that's when it dawned on his mother, Catherine Mathis, with a sinking feeling that she and Jeremy, his father, were dealing with a different issue altogether. This article in Rolling Stone and the photographs that accompany it will make just about anyone reading the article understand that something almost so deep that it's beyond our moral understanding is going on here. Undoubtedly, here you do have a boy who at very early ages understood himself to want to be a girl, identifying in feminine rather than in masculine traits. You also have parents who wanted to be non-judgmental and supportive of the child, and that meant that they did not seek to realign that gender identity even at the youngest stages of the boy's life. Now Coy is recognized legally by the state of Colorado and by the public schools as a girl, but he's also on the near side of puberty. And as the article makes very clear, hard decisions are yet to be made by his parents and Coy as to what will happen next. The article goes into considerable detail, incredible detail, and it's the kind of detail that many Christians, understanding this issue from afar, will never want actually to understand or to know. But we need to come face to face with this reality, otherwise we're not going to be competent nor accurate in dealing with it. And mark my words, every church, if not every family, will quite soon have to deal with this in one way or another. As the article in Rolling Stone makes clear, children on this side of puberty are now being given puberty blockers in order to buy time, blockers that hormonally keep them from developing secondary sex characteristics until they and their parents and presumably others, including therapists, can decide what needs to be done. What you're looking at here is the fact that there is now, in this culture, a deep understanding of sexuality and gender in which it makes sense to an enormous number of people, very influential people, that a boy can declare himself to be a girl can declare himself to be a boy. We're not just talking about men and women, we're talking about very young children. In the case of Coy Mathis, the inescapable reality that we're talking about a very young child. Now, in this article advertised on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. The cultural pace of what's going on here is made very clear in this article, and I quote, although 623 American colleges and universities have already adopted non-discrimination policies to cover gender expression, let me just stop there for a moment, you heard that number right, 623, That means that the mainstream in secular education, and probably in private education writ large as well, is to write in non-discrimination policies on the issue of gender expression. But Rolling Stone goes on to say it's not only 623 American colleges and universities, but also high schools and middle schools that are now being forced to grapple with the question of how to deal with trans students in their locker rooms, athletic fields, and bathrooms. The magazine goes on to say it's a haphazard fight raging at district, county, and state levels. Thus far, and here's what's crucial, 2013 has been what appears to be a watershed year. The magazine goes on to say, this past winter, educators in Massachusetts, Maine, and Portland, Oregon, issued guidelines to accommodate trans students, allowing them to use bathrooms and play on sports teams corresponding to the gender with which they identify. You can put in parentheses after that, for now. But in August, California trumped them all by becoming the first state to pass legislation spelling out that transgender students can choose which bathrooms, locker rooms, and sport teams they wish based on their gender identity. The national headline, says the magazine, have inspired debate over whether this is a laudable move to recognize the needs of trans kids or a wrong-headed manifestation of overindulgent parenting. They then asked the question every reader of the magazine must be asking. After all, what does a child really know about authentic identity or about what's best for them? In terms of the great moral shift, which is always just a part of a larger great worldview shift, there's a very revealing portion of this article. I read, building on the gains of LGB, that's lesbian, gay, and bisexual activists, the trans rights movement is having its moment, advancing more swiftly than even its advocates ever imagined. The magazine goes on to say, this past May, that's May of 2013, the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders was updated to replace its old classification for trans people that was then known as gender identity disorder with gender dysphoria, reflecting the new understanding that having a gender identity that doesn't match your birth anatomy doesn't make you mentally ill. Only any associated distress is considered a problem. That's where this article reveals more than maybe Rolling Stone magazine even understands. In other words, this very significant shift, a great moral shift that took place just this past May, after all, is a shift that says if there's a problem, if there's a moral problem when it comes to this gender identity issue, it's not on the part of the person who may think the gender identity is other than their birth gender, but on the society that inflicts something less than total acceptance upon them. The new therapeutic model is known as the affirmative model, building on that decision back from this past May of the American Psychiatric Association. According to this new approach, children may live as their preferred gender, complete with appropriate clothing, pronouns, and often a new name. The social transition that follows this new model is expected for kids as young as those under age 10, to get them ready by the time they reach puberty, or would normally reach puberty, to be fully adjusted and well on their way to becoming a gender other than what their birth gender was known to be. And looking back to Coy Mathis, the magazine makes very clear that the decision handed down in Colorado in his favor is a significant turning point in the national debate. As the magazine states, the determination is the nation's very first to effectively uphold the rights of trans students to use the bathrooms reflective of their identities, and it is being viewed as a landmark case. Eliza Bayard, executive director of the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network, known as GLSEN, said, this decision happened in the middle of a cresting wave. This case was hugely important to call attention to the fact that when it comes down to it, schools have an obligation not to discriminate. End quote. The most important part of that statement by Eliza Bayard is where she points to the Coy Mathis decision and identifies it as happening in the middle of a cresting wave. That cresting wave is such a powerful and, I think, accurate description of where we are. We come back repeatedly to talk about the scale and velocity of the moral change taking place around us. And yet, just on this one issue, taken alone, an issue that is so huge in its significance that it's almost impossible to exaggerate it, you now have those who are looking to the year 2013 as, quote, a watershed year, speaking of this year and the events that have taken place on this issue within it, as being just the middle of a cresting wave. In other words, they're looking for this wave finally to crest a long way beyond where we are now. And that's the moral logic of this article and of the very issue that it seeks to describe. Finally, when we come to considering how change takes place in a society, we cannot escape reference to politics, because when it comes right down to it, politics in terms of elections and political decisions are largely the mechanisms whereby these kinds of changes are affected within a society, especially within a democratic society, where if politics isn't everything and it's not everything, eventually politics will touch everything, including the very issues we've been discussing in this edition of The Briefing. That's where a recent column published in one of the nation's most influential magazines, The New Yorker in this case, makes very clear that one of the issues that we should note from last Tuesday's election is that very few Americans are actually voting, fewer than in recent election cycles. 2013, says The New Yorker, marked a depressing low. In New Jersey, the turnout of eligible voters was 37.6%, down an astonishing 10 points from the governor's race just 4 years ago. In other words, far less than half of the eligible voters in the state of New Jersey even decided to vote in an election that virtually everyone in New Jersey knew was important. In New York City, voters there faced an epic battle in terms of the election for mayor, but only 24% of the eligible voters in New York City even turned out to vote. But don't be too hard on New Yorkers, because as it turns out, their pathetic 24% voter turnout vastly exceeded the turnout in similar cities that also elected mayors, including Atlanta, Houston, Pittsburgh, and Detroit. In those cities, the percentages barely broke into double digits. Something clearly is happening in America. The fall off in New Jersey was double digits, and in the state of Virginia, 43% of eligible voters voted in last week's election for governor there, but in 1989, it was 67%. Election by election, state by state, even city by city, it's becoming more and more apparent that an increasing number of Americans eligible to vote are not voting. Let's consider what that means. It means that those who are voting have an inordinate vote. It means that when you have a minority of eligible voters voting, those who are voting are counting more than one. In a city like Detroit, they counted almost as if they were 10 citizens. Someone turning out to vote outvoted 10 people who didn't vote. Christians thinking about the stewardship of the vote need to recognize just how important the act of voting actually is. As is routinely observed, elections have consequences. But we also need to say that voting has consequences. So does non-voting. In any democratic system, a decision not to vote turns out to be, in itself, a vote. A vote that didn't go where it should go. And that's why Christians need to understand that not only do elections matter, the stewardship of our political responsibilities matters even more. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again on Monday for The Briefing.